This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you would like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Thank you. You may remember a month or so ago our coverage of the International Broadcasting Convention down in Brighton. Now the subject of the high-definition television battle has been written up in International Broadcasting by Phil Kierstead. Archimedes and innumerable gold prospectors are reputed to have exclaimed Eureka after making discoveries relating to the precious metal. One strains to think why a consortium set up to develop an exclusively European high-definition television system would name the project Eureka, when all that glimmered was not gold. Eureka's unveiling at the International Broadcasting Convention in Brighton turned out to be the stuff of which magic acts are made. Safely entrenched behind a Maginot line of blue-uniformed rent-a-guards and grey-uniformed attendants, Eureka attempted to give the effect of unveiling 2 years' worth of frantic research without risking substantiation of its work. IBC delegates and press were led in small groups into a tiny theatre where a hired spokesperson attempted to dazzle delegates with a Son et Lumière performance which featured specious comparisons to PAL reception and malfunctioning audiovisual equipment. The Eureka showing, billed as the highlight of a conference which focused mainly on high-definition television, seemed more the stuff of a party political conference, with a Euro-patriotic speech by Lord Young, British Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, accompanied by appearances by counterpart ministers from France and the Netherlands. Young said, "We are here to celebrate a major technological achievement. It exemplifies, I believe, the spirit of international cooperation and collaboration now found in Europe's industrial sector." Young also pushed for adoption of the Eureka 1250 line 50 Hz standard worldwide and said he hoped adoption of an inappropriate standard could be prevented. Meanwhile, 29 Japanese, American and European firms manufacturing equipment for the Japanese-sponsored 1125 60Hz high-definition television standard repaired to the University of Sussex in the hills outside Brighton, where they demonstrated their wares with openness and vigour. In the corridors of the exhibit buildings, delegates praised Eureka for bringing together 30 European commercial and government interests to develop in 2 years' time a European high-definition television system designed to shut out Japanese imports. Eureka did actually transmit live pictures from specially adapted cameras to a satellite and back to the venue in Brighton. Sony used a similar approach, relaying high-definition television pictures back and forth between London and Brighton via fibre optic cable. Eureka did manage to dispel concerns that the demonstration would be a computer simulation, as were some of the early high-definition television showings in the United States. However, Eureka officials avoided answering questions, although many of the participating firms, such as Philips, freely discussed their work on the development of a European high-definition television standard, saying, in Philips' case, that they hope to be ready with Eureka receivers in 1995 if the standard is adopted in 1992. A Philips spokesman also said there is a real possibility the consumer market will see a Laserdisc high-definition TV playback unit before satellite reception becomes possible. According to one source at IBC, cameras, displays, analog switches and mixers and analog videotape machines based on a 1250 50Hz standard are operational and, quote, very close to commercial prototypes. Prototypes of 1250 colour cameras are reported to have shown good performance. Work is still needed on digital studio equipment and motion compensation in 50Hz to 59.94Hz conversion. 30 related organisations contributed to the Eureka effort, and many were represented separately at the Brighton conference. Philips introduced an experimental four-head home VCR for HDMAC, the Eureka transmission standard. The VCR is equipped with digital time-based correction. Recording and playback are possible for HDMAC and D2MAC signals and are optional for PAL, CCAM and NTSC. Philips also displayed the HDMAC Professional Optical Video Disc Drive. Broadcast Television Systems has developed high-definition television cameras and videotape recording systems. The KCH-1000HD camera system can be adapted to several proposed HDTV scanning modes without hardware modification. The BCH-1000 component recorder is a 1-inch component videotape recorder based on the Eureka 1250 50Hz working standard. Rank Syntel gave the first demonstration of its 1250 50Hz Mark II HD Telecine, developed for the Eureka project. It is the first film-to-tape transfer machine for the Eureka standard. Thompson demonstrated its 1250 line progressive camera and a new high-definition direct view picture colour tube. It has a deflection angle of 110 degrees and a 16:9 aspect ratio screen with 36-inch diagonal dimension. One of the distinctions of Eureka is that it is not currently aimed at retransmission by a terrestrial television station. Spokespersons for the BBC, to the greater degree, and the UK's IBA, to a lesser degree, acted as if high-definition television was something reserved for the space sector, while admitting high-definition television could sound a death knell for terrestrial broadcasting. Continuing with the report by Phil Kierstead of the high-definition television battle at the International Broadcasting Convention. While advocates of the Japanese 1125 line 60-field production standard, the United States 1050 59.94Hz transmission standard, and the Eureka 1250 line 50Hz transmission standard hurled epithets at each other, the man who didn't come to dinner was throwing a long shadow over the discussions at Brighton. Henrikas Yuskiewicz, Vice Chairman of Russian Radio and Television and the USSR's Chief of Television Technology, called a meeting of 11 top television technology experts on September the 2nd in Moscow in an attempt to establish a world production standard for high-definition television. He called for a world production standard based on objective comparison through tests conducted in Moscow of the many incompatible systems now being touted. The Soviets are further complicating the standards issue because they are working on a 1350 line 50 Hz production standard for high-definition television. Yuskevicius's proposal deals only with a production standard, but it would considerably simplify worldwide exchange of programmes, since standards conversion would no longer be necessary when a programme crossed a trade barrier into new HDTV standard territory. There was a considerable amount of surprise at Brighton over the boldness of the Russian television executive's move. Many delegates had thought the Soviets were insignificant players in the world high-definition television arena. Their views were changed abruptly by the Russian proposal. Nor was the IBC just a battle between the Japanese and Europeans. Thomson, a major player in the Eureka Consortium and a major receiver manufacturer in the United States, was touting its own interim standard for broadcast advanced television. Thomson Video Equipment marketing manufacturer Jean-Pierre Lacotte spoke persuasively for immediate improvements in the current European PAL video standards. The Thomson proposal calls for an evolutionary improvement of current television pictures, first by moving to a 16:9 aspect ratio, 625 line interlaced component, then by going to a 16:9 progressive filtered component system on the way to eventual adoption of 1250/50:2 high definition system. Lacotte indicated that Thomson is also working closely with the David Sarnoff Research Center in the United States. The Sarnoff Lab appears to be the leader in the US effort to develop an NTSC-compatible advanced television system. Thomson is expected to introduce a 16:9 aspect ratio receiver late in 1989 or early 1990. Tubes for these sets are already in production. The Thomson spokesman feels competition will drive European broadcasters to compete by smart set coding for new receivers contained in their transmitted signal. Jay Chattel of Thomson put his company firmly behind the Eureka standard in his paper entitled Towards a World Studio Standard for High Definition Television. He said, HDTV will not be limited to what we have today. An evolution is foreseen. To avoid constraints in the future, this evolution must be introduced in scenarios right now. Chattel added, to go towards a worldwide studio standard, a dual approach is proposed as the first step. A single worldwide standard based on 50 Hz will be the optimum for the future due to the relation with film. High-definition television equipment was everywhere throughout the display venues, both in Brighton and at suburban Sussex University. Sony displayed a vast range of high-definition television equipment at its banishment venue at the university. In an effort to overcome its location disadvantage, Sony presented live teleconferences from the King's West Cinema, adjacent to the main venues on the Brighton beachfront. A two-way optical fibre link installed by British Telecom permitted the live teleconferencing between SVC Television in London and the King's West Cinema in Brighton. This was the first time high-definition television video teleconferencing had been demonstrated. It also showed that it is technically possible to transmit high-definition television over British Telecom's existing network. The transmission used two standard optical fibre links with combined capacity equivalent to more than 15,000 simultaneous telephone calls. At Sussex University, three production sets were operating to permit demonstrations by a variety of high-definition television vendors. One, a blue screen composite triple blue screen mat, demonstrated triple layer mat techniques perfected by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation for its high definition television production. Sony demonstrated a second generation HDVS camera, which is due on the market in the autumn. On a second two-camera television production set, Sony and Ikigami HD cameras were mounted with new Canon and Fujinon HD lenses. A third set demonstrated electronic cinematography, including NHK's 1125 line 60 Hz production system. Among other products displayed were the Quantel Graphic Paint Box, digital HDTV VTRs from Sony, the HDL2000 video disc player from Sony, Wavelink fibre optic accessories, the Symbolics 3600 paint and animation system, and lenses by Nikon. In another area, Sony showed its HDTV tape of a Genesis concert made at Wembley Stadium in Britain in July 1987. In the same area, Toshiba demonstrated the Muse encoder. Sanyo promoted its high-vision laser video disc system. NEC also had a laser disc. NAC showed the HDTV 35mm laser telecine, and a variety of projection systems were shown by Gretag Idafor, Hitachi and Panasonic. The actual technical sessions for delegates were heavily laced with discussion of high definition, starting with a theme-setting opening address by P.W. Bogles of Philips International, entitled The Eureka HDTV Project, Philosophy and Practice. Many of the papers were presented by manufacturers' representatives, bringing delegates up to date on specific technical achievements in high-definition television technology. Brighton was a showcase for high-definition television technology. It was not a showcase for international cooperation on future telecommunication standards.
Innovative information-based radio, broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Facts. 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
And now it's time for another million selling single from Eddie Caffrey.
Where Did Our Love Go by The Supremes. Released on the Motown record label in the USA and the Stateside record label in the UK in the year 1964. Its original UK catalogue number, SS327, backed with He Means the World to Me on the B-side. Where Did Our Love Go, the first million seller for this coloured female trio, was written by Brian Holland, Eddie Holland, and Lament Dozier, known as Holland, Dozier, and Holland. The disc was number one for 2 weeks in the USA, with 14 weeks in the American Hot 100. The Supremes were Diana Ross, born March 26, 1944, in Detroit. Mary Wilson, born 6th of March, 1944, in Mississippi. And Florence Ballard, born 30th of June, 1943, in Detroit. All were close friends from childhood days in Detroit. In their last year at school, they won a talent contest, which brought them to the notice of Motown Records. They were signed and made their first disc, I Want a Guy. This became a big hit in America. They made subsequent personal appearances in New York, Washington, and elsewhere. They appeared on British radio and TV in late 1964 with great success. They were the only girl group to have 11 discs at number one in the USA by 1968. Where Did Our Love Go reached number three in Britain and spent 14 weeks in the British top 30 in 1964. They had made 100 discs and earned $1,500,000 in 1965. This disc sold over 2 million. A top rhythm and blues disc, The Supremes, Where Did Our Love Go?
Yeah.
is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime, with Holly Robson
and Trevor Brooke.
Now to the Daily Telegraph. Keeping alive a tattered vision, Virginia Matthews on the latest bid to rescue ailing Super Channel. To many established media types, the words Super Channel have become synonymous with overambition, bad management, and unmitigated financial disaster. For Richard Branson, who yesterday announced details of yet another rescue bid for the station, Super Channel will prove the critics knaves or fools. Branson's vision is to create the best English language news service in Europe, interspersed with heavy doses of music and the occasional film. ITN is likely to continue providing the Super Channel news service, but if the two sides cannot agree terms, VisNews is waiting in the wings. Of the early vision, an English language general entertainment channel for Europe, little remains. Nor do any of the original non-Virgin Group shareholders. All ITV companies, with the exception of Thames. Branson's new partner is a well-seasoned Italian television company, Video Music, committed to providing the next £6 million worth round of funding. Virgin retains 45% shareholding, while the Italians have the remainder. The best of British programming, it trumpeted when the UK-based European satellite service was launched 21 months ago. Today, as Branson and Video Music attempt to stem total losses of £60 million, it's going to need the best of British luck. The initial premise of Super Channel, as visualised by the ITV companies in the mid-80s, was simple enough. English-speaking Europeans from Stockholm to Stuttgart were crying out for quality television, the sort their indigenous programme makers could not provide, and to get it were prepared to wrestle with English phrasebooks. The ITV companies also considered it an efficient way of using repeats, a quick way of putting advertisements round BBC programmes, and an effective way of warding off Rupert Murdoch's domination of the European market with Sky Channel. And while, the theory went, well-educated Europeans were absorbed in All Creatures Great and Small, Spitting Image or Hotel du Lac, the well-briefed advertisers, such as Austin Rover, Schweppes and Levi's, would be marshalling in their era of pan-European advertising, funding Super Channel with an anticipated £20 million in annual advertising revenue. The practice, however, has been disappointing. While Super Channel has access to impressive 13.5 million households in 15 European countries, including 143,000 in the UK, viewing figures are patchy. Take-up has been high in Holland and Scandinavia, where much local television is serious and heavy going. But interest has been low in Germany. It's a large chauvinistic nation, says the executive chairman of Super Channel, Robert Devereux, the third man to have headed the station. And if viewing has been poor, advertising revenue has been less than £7 million a year, just slightly less than Sky has attracted. Worse, despite Super Channel's remit to cater for upmarket rather than popularist taste, Rupert's Sky has been exporting mass-market Australian and American soaps to Europe for 6 years and has lost £4 million before Super Channel began. Its most consistent success has been Benny Hill. The history of the pan-European network has been dogged by management incompetence, internecine shareholder rivalry, and a remarkable lack of faith. Although Super Channel project was given 5 years to make good, many of the original ITV shareholders sold out within months of the launch. Of the original lineup, only Branson remains. The question of whether well-heeled Europeans actually want English language programming without the benefit of subtitles has not been resolved. Super Channel critics say the notion is patronising and unworkable. Pre-launch, the Independent Contractors Association, now the ITVA, carried out feasibility studies in Europe on behalf of the ITV companies and identified two markets – one for upmarket English language programming and the other for pan-European advertising campaigns. But if there is such a viewer demand, who realistically is going to fund it? The concept of pan-European marketing looks more viable in the context of 1992 and the single market. Yet the very advertising agencies who had been floating the idea pre the Super Channel launch have been unable to deliver the goods. Ever the optimist, Branson said this week that pan-European marketing has been talked about for a long time, but there are now signs that it's becoming a reality. However, at boardroom level, it has been a choice of programming which has led to some of the more colourful rows and defections. Critics say more experienced programmers and skillful programming could have made a success of it. The station, which sets out with high hopes of bringing quality British television to the rest of Europe, is now far more popularist than its original creators intended. The confessions of a driving instructor, holiday camp instructor, and window cleaner figured in October's schedules. Super Channel set off with a hopeless programming policy, says Devereux, and there was profligate spending on the programming department. Our progress on what was an appalling and shambolic start has been impressive. One untarnished jewel in the Super Channel crown remains its news service. Supplied by ITN and presented by John Suchet, the 5 days a week roundup of world events has been feted for its authoritative and lucid coverage, from speeches by Soviet leader Gorbachev to traffic accidents outside Paris. The best hope for Super Channel, says one rather jaded former director, is that the ITV companies have pulled out. Some of the very companies that initially backed up and are now balking at the £60 million debit are about to risk a total £600 million in the launch of British satellite broadcasting. I just hope that they have little more faith in their current venture. But until it can be proved, through ratings and advertising revenue, that English-speaking European businessmen want to think English at home as well as at work, any public show of faith looks premature.
And then Media Network on Radio Netherlands had a look at the Super Channel operation.
Week we mentioned that the satellite TV station Super Channel had been saved by Italian investors, Beta TV. Super hasn't been such a super success, losing some £60 million over the last couple of years. As a follow-up, Wayne Brittenden asked Michael Schlagmann, who's advertising sales director for Super Channel, what difference the change in ownership will make.
I don't think the viewer will certainly see any major changes until the new year. We're mainly planning to keep the service pretty much as it is today through till the end of this year. We have a number of commitments, particularly advertising commitments, which we intend to keep going. The main changes, therefore, will be starting January, and then the viewer will start seeing a greater emphasis on those programmes that have been most popular, particularly the news service, which ITN have been providing and has been immensely successful, and the music programmes, which have been running now for 4 years through the days of Music Box and then Super Channel.
Clearly, there are going to be different expectations from the new owners to the kind of brief that Super Channel started out with.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that some of the ideals that Super Channel started with were a little bit muddled and became clearer as time went on, as often happens as you gain experience in a particular marketplace.
One of the mistakes seems to be made at the very opening of the service in January 87.
I want to say, not only to people here, but to our viewers in Europe, that I'm delighted to be here this evening at this super party for Super Channel to celebrate the launch of a service which will give our friends all over Europe the very best of British.
Unfortunately, Mrs. Thatcher was not perhaps as well briefed as she ought to have been. The internal objective of Super Channel was never, and I do mean this, never, to be a best of British service. It was designed to offer the best of British programming that would appeal to a European audience, and great care was taken in the early days to choose programming that was not just good British programming, but that would have an appeal in a European environment. We managed to achieve that to perhaps only a degree of 60-70%, and many of the programs we chose, because this was such a new idea, were wrong, and they were quickly changed. People now believe that with the new owners, with the new funding, and with the new prospects, that Super Channel is going to take its place as a major channel within Europe.
Looking ahead, Rupert Murdoch has promised with his Sky Channel that cheap decoders are going to be available with the Astra satellite system by early next year. Does that give you some nervousness?
I don't see why it should, because I don't see us being in direct competition with Sky Channel. I've always felt that there was room for a number of different channels operating in Europe, and the intention that I've seen in everything that's come out of Sky so far is to reorientate their signal towards the UK and eventually drop a European service. They'll be using a UK clock, and everything will be orientated towards the UK. So I see that Super Channel can take its place as the premier European service very, very quickly.
Media Network with Jonathan Marks there from Radio Netherlands. Electronic Times, MVDS could provide up to 12 television channels by Chris Bennett. Broadcasting bosses look set to be offered yet another medium as the government publishes a white paper on the use of microwave video distribution services. MVDS, a cheap and easy way of providing television services. Management consultant Touche Ross has prepared a report for the Department of Trade and Industry, which concludes that MVDS could be used to provide up to 12 television channels within 2 years, at a lower cost than direct broadcast by satellite or cable. The Touche Ross report, published by the DTI, looks at three scenarios for the introduction of MVDS and concludes that a low-frequency 1 to 6 GHz system could be introduced at a cost of £220 per customer. This compares favourably with DBS, which is dependent upon successful satellite launches, costing between £275 and £330. Cable comes an expensive third at a cost of up to £1,700 per customer. British Telecom has already demonstrated such an MVDS system in Suffolk, which shows that systems between 2 GHz and 30 GHz are feasible. Despite the lower bandwidth a 2 GHz system allows, equipment for such a system could be bought off the shelf from the United States, while equipment for medium and high frequency systems would need to be developed. Touche Ross stated that the competitive advantage of MVDS relied on the timing of its introduction. The competitive advantages which MVDS offer over cable or DBS depends on a service being available before another television delivery system has established a breakthrough in market share.
From The Guardian, turning a blind ear to radio. Martin Lote tunes into a creative gap at the Radio 88 talk-in at Dubrovnik. The creatives can't crack radio advertising. The highly paid wunderkinds of Britain's top agencies love to dream up terrific television commercials, gorgeous double-page spreads in glossy magazines, and even punchy posters for billboards. But take their crayons and pencils away, ask them to shut their eyes and work with sound alone, and they shake their heads in disbelief and start to moan. Radio doesn't turn them on. The latest episode of this long-running debate on the dearth of stimulating and exciting radio advertising, as opposed to the cheapskate hectoring monologues so often employed, took place at the Radio 88 conference last weekend in Dubrovnik, Yugoslavia. British commercial radio bosses, agencies and advertisers gathered in the Hotel Croatia and agreed that although the general outlook for the industry is buoyant, with ad revenue well up, new stations planned and technical innovations catching on, the crassness of many commercials is the real fly in the ether. Why? Some clues were given in a dual presentation by media experts Ken New of Abbott Mead Vickers, SMS, and John Ayling of John Ayling Associates, which included taped interviews with assorted agency worthies. Many London-based advertising professionals know nothing about local commercial radio and never hear anything beyond Capital and LBC. Worse, many who do listen positively dislike what they hear. Travelling around the country, I was mentally numbed by the material between music, said one ad man. The message was that associating with radio brings little cachet to the glamour-hooked advertising industry. This was summed up by one creative type whose aim was to win awards rather than help his clients shift more product. It's very difficult to make yourself famous with radio. Because creative people see radio ads as a second division activity compared to other media, the radio jobs are usually given to agency juniors to cut their teeth on. The problem is compounded because although it's relatively easy to write a mediocre script, it's very difficult to produce a good radio commercial, such as the River Deep Mountain High spoofs for DHL couriers, or the high musical quality of the TDK tape series. Richard Carter of TDK's agency Newton and Godin commented, "Radio advertising is a very revealing medium. You can't disguise a poor idea with layers of visual gloss. Your idea has to stand or fall on its own." Radio's ability to extend television advertising by stimulating mental pictures was the gist of a presentation by Caroline Bell of BMS, the conference organisers. She claimed listeners to radio ads often subconsciously imagine related television pictures. Research into Brookbond DT advertising in the Northwest showed up to 20% of people thought they had seen the product advertised on television, when in fact only radio and bus side advertising was used. Where both television and radio advertising was used, radio listeners showed much higher awareness of television advertising than non-listeners, she said. It appears radio kept the television commercial top of mind. The Brookbond D radio ad cleverly drew on the theme of its television counterpart, young woman staggers to a hard day at the office and could do with a D, without merely playing the unadapted TV soundtrack. On radio, the daily hazards depicted on the screen were replaced by new sound effects and sharp editing. This is one example of creative advertising working with the strengths of radio rather than rubbing it up the wrong way with endless phone numbers and manic ranting by witless salesmen. Unfortunately, too few can deliver the goods. As one Dubrovnik delegate said, maybe these advertising creative chaps aren't all they're cracked up to be.
Now I've got in my hands a document that somebody would very much like to get their hands on. It's published by Farnell Electronic Components in Leeds, and it's a comprehensive cross-reference and Starline listing, which is associated with the Farnell catalogue. What it consists of is a listing of other supplier stock number, which in fact is the stock numbers for RS components items, listed against the Farnell order code. And this also provides Starline item indication, directory placement, near alternatives, or check Farnell catalogue for further details. And what's happened now is that despite Farnell producing this kind of list for the past 2 years or so, RS components have now issued an injunction against Farnell. And until the full court hearing, Farnell are required to recall all of these documents which have been issued. So if you've got one and you want to hang on to it, you better hide it underneath the bed or something.
ProSound News reports that Jean-Michel Jarre's communications link-up was one of the UK's most complex. One of the most vital elements of the Destination Docklands concerts was the communication setup, which linked directors, operators, and technicians spread over an area of 5 square miles, with some of them up to 2 kilometres away from the Royal Victoria Dock. Three companies worked together on this side of the event: Fine Point Broadcast, Theatre Project Sound and Vision Department, and Raycom, the latter supplying the radio walkie-talkie units needed for those too far away to use belt packs. The 11 directors overseeing the various effects needed to speak to the approximately 250 operators around the site. For the belt pack system, a hierarchy of talkback was created, with the master directors able to talk to the individual directors, who spoke to the operational directors, who in turn spoke to the operators. In the region of 15 rings were used, with never more than 20 people on a circuit at any one time. Clearcom and Technical Projects belt pack units were utilised, with each device joined together by 8 kilometres of 8-pair cable, plus another 4 kilometres of individual single-pair cable. Finepoint's head of engineering, Peter Baker, described the setup as not only a complicated system, but big in terms of quantity. It was configured as a two-wire system, which made for easier operation and reduced cost. It halved the amount of cable we used, said Baker. Despite these advantages, some crosstalk and interference was experienced using the system. The directors were located in a control tower positioned directly in front of the stage, some 150 metres from the edge of the dock. It took 500 metres of cable to connect these two areas because the stage was moving and a swan neck had to be employed to facilitate the operation. One surprise the engineers did get was when the barge moved away from the side of the dock for the first time on which the stage was placed, which resulted in the loss of earth and so failure of the talkback system. This happened only a few hours before showtime and had to be rapidly corrected. This talkback system had to be interfaced into 5 duplex radio channels for the more distant operators who couldn't be reached by cable. 5 constant carrier radio transmitters were brought into operation, with special UHF licenses granted by the Department of Trade and Industry. 3 VHF licenses were granted whilst rigging was in progress, and a further 4 UHF channels assigned on the Wednesday before the shows. This was the first time any production has been granted a special UHF license by the DTI. This side of the Destination Docklands production took 2 weeks to assemble, with work beginning on the 27th of September and finishing on the 7th of October, the Friday before the first gig. De-rigging took until the Wednesday afternoon following the shows. That was a report by Kevin Hilton from ProSound News.
And now Jonathan Marks at Media Network had a look at the British Broadcasting White Paper.
Media Network. We get the facts straight, and then we straighten the facts.
On Monday, the British government published its white paper entitled Broadcasting in the 90s, Competition, Choice and Quality. Immediately, the British media started delving deep into this complex document, although most of the discussion focused heavily on what the Conservative government plans to do with television. Radio wasn't given much of a mention. In short, 2 additional channels will be allocated on the British Direct Broadcast satellite, due to be launched next year. A 5th national terrestrial television channel should be operating by 1993. Then 3 new national commercial radio channels should be launched, 2 of them on medium wave. That should be interesting. Community radio is to be introduced. Local television services will also be possible, distributed by microwave or cable. The BBC domestic service will have to explore ways to fund its operation by a subscription system, rather than an across-the-board licence fee. And note that doesn't affect the BBC World Service, which is funded in a different way. Quite a mouthful, then. Well, the British Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, told Parliament what the bill's trying to do.
We aim to ensure that viewers and listeners have greater freedom of choice from a more varied output of programme. Our television has a deservedly high reputation in the world, and we expect that reputation to grow with the opportunities which are now in sight.
The Shadow Home Secretary, Labour's Roy Hattersley, took a different line.
It pretends to offer choice. In fact, many of the new channels will do no more than offer vast profits to the tycoons of international television. It is a giant retreat from the concept of public sector broadcasting. Its result will be less diversity and lower standards. Yay!
The Independent Broadcasting Authority is to be abolished and replaced by a less regulated Independent Television Commission. Richard Dunn, chairman of the Independent Television Association, which represents commercial TV in Britain at the moment, was asked for his reaction.
We're not against more choice. In fact, we're rather in favour of more choice, and many of us, almost all of us, are investing in more choice. Nor are we against competition. But what we do wonder, having received this document, it's heavy on detail and perhaps lightish on analysis, is whether the government has got the balance right between providing that wider choice and maintaining high standards of broadcasting, which the British public have traditionally enjoyed.
The deregulation of British broadcasting is being watched closely by other European countries. Public broadcasting corporations are expensive, and some would argue essential to keep standards high. The BBC's Director General Michael Checkland doesn't seem worried about the future.
I think we're very pleased that the government have recognised the public service broadcasting role of the BBC in the new competitive environment. And we're pleased to see words which ask us to concentrate on quality of programming, range of quality, diversity of programming, because that is how we see the BBC's role, and we're delighted to see it confirmed today.
So where does that leave shortwave? At present, a British group is hiring airtime on an Irish transmitter to broadcast programmes to those interested in technology here in Europe.
Broadcasting to the European community, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Facts, the trade station. Number one.
Well, that station can only exist at present because the Irish haven't cracked down on the pirates. Instead, they've announced stiff penalties and a legal local radio system as from the end of this year. Trevor Brooke is the head of Radio Facts, it's called, and we put it to him that the new white paper doesn't seem to have considered his idea for legal low-power shortwave broadcasting at all.
No, it seems to be the same position as the Green Paper, which made no mention of any new services being considered for HF from Britain, and we've raised the issue, as we had before the Green Paper was published, with the government after the Green Paper, expressing disappointment that the subject didn't even seem to have been considered. The Green Paper does have a very short paragraph about HF where it considers it and dismisses it as completely unsuitable. And it is unsuitable for most people's application, but it does have use for specialised services, we would have thought.
You did approach the Independent Broadcasting Authority there?
Yes, recently, because of their project for 20 community radio licenses, they defined several categories of service. One of the categories was community of interest, and the service we want to provide fits absolutely ideally into this definition of community of interest. Unfortunately, we've had a reply from the chairman of the IBA, Lord Thompson, personally, who has said to us that he regards the project as a very exciting one, but the IBA is not allowed under present legislation to provide licences for anything other than local broadcasting.
But it is important to point out that this is a white paper, not necessarily law.
That's right. It is a discussion document, and the bill which will follow from it will not appear till autumn 1989. So we keep on suggesting that HF be included in the bill.
But how long has Radio Facts got?
We finish at the end of December when the new law comes into force in Ireland, so that we remain a legal operation, and our final proper speech programme will go out on the 11th of December, and we'll then just play music up to the end of December. We will have then been on the air for over 3 months, 24 hours a day, continuously, and I think that the actual fact of being on the air has been worth more than 1,000 words in describing the concept that we had.
Finally, you have two frequencies, the 6205 during the day and the 1611 at night. What brings the most response, and what sort of numbers are you talking about?
Well, it's been quite intriguing. The response is more than 100 letters per week, and they're split more or less 50-50 between the two frequencies. And the shortwave signal covers the British Isles fairly reasonably, and then progressively gets weaker as you go further out. But we have had reports from both sides of the United States and from New Zealand and from Canada.
Which isn't bad for 230 watts.
Not at all bad.
That was a strangely familiar sounding voice, I think you'll agree, talking to Jonathan Marks on Media Network from Radio Netherlands. And now to the Daily Telegraph and a letter on the white paper, Vague on Future of TV Arts. Sir, your editorial on the broadcasting white paper rightly points out that by throwing the airwaves open to market forces, the government must take responsibility to ensure the new system produces television no worse than we have now. On the evidence of the white paper proposals for the contractors' tendering procedure for the new style Channel 3 and 5, the government is taking that responsibility lightly. First, the white paper says that new contractors must produce a diverse service calculated to appeal to a variety of tastes and interests. Fine, but these are vague demands. Do they include arts, documentary, or children's programmes? If so, why not say now? We are concerned that the government knows that these categories will not prove commercially attractive to the new contractors, and so they will be discarded. Next, the new Independent Television Commission, that's ITC, is obliged to award new contracts to the highest bidders from these companies which have passed a so-called quality threshold. Thereafter, free market reigns. The commitment to programme standards then becomes a token gesture, and we will not get the best television service attainable, only the most commercial. The viewer will only have a choice of quality programmes if the government accepts its responsibility to create an environment in which they can be produced. The smaller share of advertising revenue available to all new contractors means there will not be the finance to make many of the arts, documentary and polished drama programmes that millions of viewers enjoy today. Unless the new ITC makes producing them a clear condition of the contract, they will not be made. As I say, that was a letter to the Daily Telegraph from John Blake, Campaign for Quality Television, Manchester.
And now to some of your letters to Radio Facts. Thank you to Carl Erik Strid from Höganäs in Sweden. And also, I have had the pleasure of picking up your programmes this morning, says Eric D. Pepper, Garforth, West Yorkshire in England.
Over to the States and a letter from Jerry Berg from Lexington, Massachusetts. Today I was very pleased and surprised to hear your reception on shortwave. Let me tell you a little about myself. I'm 44 years old, an attorney and court administrator in our state district court system. My wife, Ruth, is a teacher. She teaches educationally disadvantaged students at the elementary school level. We have two children, Evan, age 17, and Laurie, age 14. Lexington is about 10 miles from Boston. I'm a member of several shortwave clubs and also the chairperson of a special committee of the Association of North American Radio Clubs. It's called the Committee to Preserve Radio Verifications, and its purpose is to try to save the destruction of old radio verifications that might otherwise be discarded when their owners die or become inactive. This material is of great historical significance to the hobby. We have about 15,000 QSLs under roof right now, going all the way back to the 20s. Well, thanks for your letter, Jerry, and it's really good to know that you're picking us up over in the States.
And from Turku in Finland, I work in a local radio station. This radio station is called Radio Oran Alot. Our station is 3 years old, and we were one of those experimental stations which started in 1985. Now 35 commercial local radio stations are on the air in our country. Oran Alot is still the only commercial in Turku, but we will get a competitor next year. It was very hard to start 3 years ago, as commercial radio was a totally new media. But now our annual budget is $3 to $4 million. We are on the air daily 15 hours and more at weekends. The music copyright is too high in Finland to have a 24-hour service. Oran Alot is mostly a local news radio with only about 50% music. We have 12 journalists for every day and in all 25 people working full-time and over 10 assistants part-time. My work as the station is a studio manager, but I also do music and other programmes. We have 3 studios and a monitor studio and 1 reporter car. The transmitting frequency is 90.5 MHz VHF in stereo with 100 watts of power. The government do not allow more. Thank you, Harry Kajula from Turku, Finland, who also says, most of all, I hope you will get a licence from your government next year.
And now to Raynham in Essex, which is home to Michael Harm. He writes, I thought I would drop you a line to say how much I enjoy your broadcasts. They sound very professional and are always informative. The only criticism I have is at times some of the talks are far too technical for the average listener. Well, Michael, they're actually also far too technical for the average voiceover, but never mind about that. I have some knowledge of electronics and radio, but, for example, your 16th of October talk on a VCR operation went right over my head. All the best of luck to everybody at Radio Facts, from Michael Hahn of Raynham, Essex.
Thank you to Roberto Pavanello from Vercelli in Italy for your letter. And I think your programme was very interesting. I'm very keen on computers, radios, satellite systems, etc. I hope I can hear your broadcasts again here in Mikkeli in Finland. I work in Finnish Broadcasting Company's local radio called Radio Mikkeli as a sound mixer. Thank you, Juha Blomberg from Mikkeli in Finland, for that letter.
Over to Ireland and a letter from Tom Myrtle, who writes, I live in Southwest Ireland and am an amateur radio operator. I think the articles you broadcast are very interesting. I am an electronics technician by profession and find a lot of your information very useful and interesting. For years, other stations broadcast information, but only for 10 or 15 minutes. Your station is providing an excellent service, neglected in the past. As I'm involved with radio and aerials, etc., I enjoy your programme. I also liked the items on satellite TV and on computer security. I hope your station continues for many years and keep up the good work. I'm sure you have many listeners and maybe one day will be stereo on satellite worldwide. All the best for now, Radio Facts. Good luck for the future. From Tom Mortell.
I have been listening to your station for several months. I find it refreshingly different from other stations on shortwave, says Dr. David Stevenson from Exeter in Devon, England.
We've just read a letter from Jerry Berg, who comes from Lexington in the States, which included some information about the Committee to Preserve Radio Verifications. Here's a little bit more about that particular society. The Committee to Preserve Radio Verifications is a five-person group whose goal is to preserve verifications belonging to hobbyists who are no longer active. QSL collections have been lost when persons pass away or left the hobby, and their QSL collections were misplaced or discarded. This material is an important part of the history of radio and of great interest to radio enthusiasts. It's hoped that in the future, through the committee's efforts, more QSLs will be saved from loss or destruction. The committee encourages QSL collectors to make arrangements with us for the future preservation of their collections and not leave the fate of their QSLs to chance. The committee is a committee of the Association of North American Radio Clubs. ANARC was founded in 1964 as a unifying organisation for non-profit radio clubs in the United States and in Canada. Its objectives are the promotion of closer ties and the interchange of information and ideas among member clubs, working for the common good of the hobby, and providing a medium to speak out on behalf of clubs and listeners. Thousands of radio hobbyists belong to ANARC member clubs. The committee's work. We work towards our goal in several ways. Firstly, by our activity, we hope to cause more hobbyists to think about the long-term importance of their QSL collections. Second, the committee will provide a central repository for QSLs. Through direct contact with inactive listeners and the families of deceased hobbyists, and by a public information campaign, the committee seeks out existing QSL collections that might otherwise be lost and takes steps to preserve them. Third, the committee will be available to serve as recipient for any QSL collections that hobbyists might wish to dispose of in their will. The committee is prepared to archive all QSL cards and letters received. At the outset, the committee is concentrating on QSLs from shortwave broadcast stations, large and small. However, the committee considers itself an all-wave project and welcomes QSLs covering medium wave, utility, and other stations as well. Since today's QSLs are tomorrow's history, the committee wants to archive QSLs of more recent origin as well as vintage material. So hobbyists with new collections are as important to us as old-timers. Likewise, we're interested in routine QSLs just as much as rare ones. So what does happen to QSLs that are donated to the committee? All material is handled with care. Each QSL is placed in an individual envelope, carefully marked with a donor's name and filed in neat, orderly fashion. A computerized index is maintained so that all material can be assessed quickly and easily. Each QSL is fully attributed to the donor. Well, if any of you out there have got any collections that you would like to donate to the Committee to Preserve Radio Verifications, here's the address to write to. Jerry Berg, Chairperson, 38 Eastern Avenue, Lexington, MA 02173, the USA.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Somehow closer now. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations. Good vibrations.
If you get used to listening to AM signals through a synchronous detector, you will find it quite painful if you have to go back to an envelope detector. The improvement in signal-to-noise ratio and reduction in chatter from adjacent stations is particularly helpful on weak or fading signals. We produce a complete boxed phase-lock synchronous detector, which accepts 455 kHz IF input to suit many receivers. The two audio line level outputs can be fed into a hi-fi stereo system, and the four front panel controls allow reception of double sideband, upper sideband, lower sideband, stereo spread or independent sideband with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and improves the audibility of weaker co-channel signals, and finally, a low distortion envelope detector. Apart from all this, there is also an audio level controller, which counteracts the objectionable surging in loudness as the carrier goes through a selective fade, and the automatic gain control in the receiver unnecessarily increases the gain. The unit costs £150, and a detailed four-page information sheet is available if you send along one 14 pence British stamp or one international reply coupon to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
From ProSound News, BBC radio show searches for a new sense of identity, an article by Kevin Hilton. London. The first BBC radio show since 1966 was held at the Earls Court Exhibition Centre from the 1st to the 9th of October. This event has been highly publicised and gave the public the opportunity to meet celebrities and see how programmes are put together. Despite a healthy attendance, the show seemed unsure of who it was meant to appeal to. The radio show was, in effect, a giant birthday party for the four national BBC networks and BBC local radio, which all came into being 21 years ago. Over the 9 days of the exhibition, the public had the chance to see a number of Radio 1, 2, 3 and 4 and LR programmes either recorded or broadcast live from Earls Court, where studios have been constructed along the main stage, where the likes of Tapao, Womack and Womack and the Jazz Warriors performed. When not watching these events or finding out what it's like to be a newsreader, visitors could wander around the rest of the exhibition, where in companies as diverse as Boosey and Hawkes, the BPI, Harman Audio, Ensonique, Celestian International, HW International, Mothercare, the Automobile Association, WH Smith, and even the Royal Air Force were showing their wares. EMI had set up a small Abbey Road recording booth on its stand so that the brave or very self-possessed could make a demo tape, singing to well-known backing tracks. Taking up a fair amount of space was the Story of Radio section, which attempted to present a journey through the historical events of the medium's development over the years. As an idea, this could have worked well, with AV presentations and displays showing such happenings. What was presented was a series of photographs, a few historical jottings, and a montage of famous excerpts, which were snatched as the visitor proceeded through the display. The overall effect was a sketch, an outline, but not a history. So who was this event aimed at? Before the opening, the cynics said the show would be full of anoraks, the fanatical followers of wireless who plague radio stations in pursuit of autographs and stickers. There were a number of these, resplendent in traditional garb, adorned with many and various enamel badges, clutching their BBC plastic carrier bags stuffed with handouts. In addition, there were many middle-aged people, who are probably still radio listeners on a more substantial scale than most. Schoolchildren made up a percentage, along with those who just seemed curious. The BBC radio show cannot be dismissed out of hand. Those attending seemed to be enjoying the activities, and some of the exhibitors were doing business, though few expressed vague doubts concerning the validity of their presence. But the show still appeared to be out of time. The sad fact is that if this had also included television, the attendance would probably have been higher. The terrible thing is that in the days before the biggest changes ever to hit UK radio, does this seemingly vague interest in radio show indicate a slump in the interest in radio itself?
And now something you'll definitely need your anorak for, Wave and Current Sensing by HF Radar. A brief review of HF radio oceanography is given together with an assessment of the difficulties in extending this to include wave sensing. Various methods of estimating the two-dimensional spectrum of waves on the sea surface from one-dimensional radar Doppler spectra are considered, and a technique is proposed based on the maximum entropy method. It is shown that if a pair of vector radars are used to provide two independent views of the same patch of sea, then further information can be gained by operating the radars bistatically. Observations made at Flamborough Head in March 1986 are used to test a few of the basic properties of the theoretical bistatic cross-section of the sea surface. This is in the Journal of the Institution of Electronic and Radio Engineers by S.P. Kingsley from the Department of Electronic and Electrical Engineering, University of Sheffield, and S. Rotherham from GEC Marconi Research Centre, Great Baddow, Chelmsford, England. High-frequency radar, 3 to 30 MHz, has become established as an important technique in the remote sensing of the sea surface, particularly in the last two decades, because of the increasing availability of Doppler processing. The radio echo from the sea, under normal conditions, is composed of a dominant first-order Doppler spectrum and a smaller but more complicated second-order structure. It is from the analysis of these spectral features that information is deduced on ocean surface currents, waves, wind and ice flow. Various forms of HF radar have been developed, including skywave radar, in which the radio signal is reflected from the ionosphere to survey areas at distances between 800 and 3,000 kilometres from the radar, using frequencies usually between 10 and 20 MHz. Short-range ground-wave radar, such as CODAR and the MAREX OSCR systems, which are primarily intended for making inshore current measurements at frequencies near 25 MHz. And finally, over-the-horizon ground-wave systems, which operate between 3 and 10 MHz and have a practical maximum range of perhaps 400 kilometres. In the Doppler spectrum, the first-order sea echo is composed of two spikes, or Bragg lines, which arise from those advancing and receding sea waves, which are matched to half of the radar wavelength. The relative magnitude of these lines can be used to estimate the wind direction by means of various algorithms and techniques which overcome inherent ambiguities. And there is little doubt that, within the limitations of the method, the wind directions produced are reliable. The effect of ocean surface currents is to displace the Bragg lines in the spectrum by an amount equal to the radial component of the current. The total current vector can be deduced by combining the outputs of two radars whose beams overlap orthogonally in the area of interest. Many comparisons have been made between HF radar current measurements and those made by more conventional current meters, and generally good agreements have been obtained. Apart from the resolution limitations of depth and space, HF measurement of sea currents are considered to be a useful addition to the range of techniques available, with the added advantages of wide area coverage and relative immunity to storm damage. After the Bragg lines, the next most obvious features in the Doppler spectrum are the echoes due to hard targets, such as land, oil rigs, and ships. Automatic detection and tracking of ships has recently been demonstrated at the Marconi Research Centre using data recorded with the Ocean Surface Current Radar. And although some refinement is required to the detection algorithm, no major problems have been encountered except when the radial component of the ship speed is equal to that of the waves and the echo is lost in the Bragg lines. Similarly, the detection of ice flow and the tracking of icebergs is a practical application of HF radar, though not of interest in United Kingdom waters. Then going further on in the paper, the ocean surface current radars, which were originally developed by the Rutherford and Appleton Laboratory and are now operated by MAREX, operate near 27 MHz and have sufficient power to measure ocean surface currents up to a range of 40 kilometres. At this distance, the signal-to-noise ratio is about 10 dB and is not sufficient for wave-sensing purposes, though at closer ranges a greater signal is received, and by 15 kilometres the signal-to-noise ratio becomes adequate. Although this distance is not far enough to permit true deep water trials of the inversion algorithm, it is nonetheless a relatively inexpensive method of testing the theory and reducing technical risk before embarking on a longer range wave sensing program. A suitable area for the experiment was found at Flamborough Head, where a WaveEck buoy was located sufficiently near the shore to be within range of the two OSCR radars. The water in this area has a fairly uniform depth of about 50 metres and a complicated system of tidal current flow round the head. During a survey of the area in February 1986, locations for the radars were found next to the lighthouse on Flamborough Head and on a caravan site at Gristhorpe, such that the radar beams from these two sites would cross more or less orthogonally at the location of the buoy. The experiment went ahead in early March 1986 with every expectation of bad weather. In fact, conditions were calm at first, and a considerable effort was made during this period to characterise the OSCR system by the normal radar calibration procedures, the use of an active transponder, and the measurement of antenna beam patterns by ship-borne transmitter. On the 20th of March, a storm began at 3 a.m, reaching a peak around noon, and thereby providing a good range of sea states on which to test out the inversion algorithm. On the following day, the sea was still well developed, and the bistatic observations were made. The Gristhorpe radar continued to operate normally, collecting monostatic data, whilst also acting as the bistatic illuminator. At Flamborough Head, the transmitter was not used, and the receiver was tuned to the same frequency as the Gristhorpe radar. The direct pulse from Gristhorpe was used to synchronise the timing of the AD conversions and establish range gates at the preferred ranges. In fact, a combination of range gates and beam directions was used, so that data were not only gathered near the Wavec buoy, but at other locations to cover the widest possible range of bistatic angles permitted by the geometry of the arrangement and the signal-to-noise ratio of the system. The OSCR radars are not equipped with a means of phase locking to an external reference signal, the direct pulse, and so it was necessary to replace the master oscillator with a frequency synthesizer and tune in to the Gristhorpe frequency, making manual adjustments when needed, sometimes almost continuously, though slowly, during the acquisition of data. Tests showed, however, that this did not cause serious deterioration of the spectra. The transmitting antenna at Gristhorpe was an omnidirectional monopole, providing no azimuthal information. At Flamborough Head, the receiving array was used to provide azimuth beams, which were each about 8 degrees wide, with a nominal direction denoted by theta. There is no range information available as such, only the difference in propagation delay between the direct pulse received from Gristhorpe and the echo from the sea. And to the final part of the paper, skipping all the complex mathematics. Conclusions. HF radar will have considerably increased potential for oceanography when wave sensing can be reliably added to its existing capabilities. And with the developments reviewed here, this is likely to come about in the near future. One of the main problems has been that of estimating the two-dimensional spectrum of waves on the sea from the one-dimensional Doppler spectrum observed by a single radar. Several solutions are proposed, including the use of two radars operating as a vector pair, and the use of a maximum entropy inversion method to estimate the spectrum. Given such a radar pair, it has been shown how these can also be operated bistatically to provide a third view of the wave spectrum. The data quality might then be expected to exceed that of in-situ methods, and this improvement, coupled with the wide area coverage and the all-weather capability of radar, should place HF radar at the forefront of sea sensing techniques. At the Marconi Research Centre, a long-range HF radar system is being planned for the measurement of waves and currents in the North Sea in support of the offshore oil industry. Four narrow beams will be used at any one time, and if the full 24-beam, 60-degree sector is covered, this will allow a cycle of observations to be repeated every 1.5 hours. With a maximum range of 350 kilometres for wave measurements, and further for surface currents, this means that a total area of more than 50,000 square kilometres can be surveyed. Further processing would enable shipping movements to be plotted over much of this area, and there may be other shorter range applications for integrated wave and current monitoring and vessel tracking systems. We are grateful to the Department of Energy for funding much of this work, and to the Ministry of Defence, PE, for other support. Thanks are due to all at Marex and MRC who helped with the trial at Flamborough Head, especially Chris Boyce, John Dawson and Trevor Blake, and also to Judith Pillou, who helped with the data processing.
Communications Week International reports UK grants licences to operate satellites by Dawn Hayes. London. The UK government has taken the first step toward a competitive European satellite market with the licensing of six companies to operate one-way specialised satellite services. The successful bidders are British Satellite Broadcasting, Maxwell Satellite Communications, British Aerospace PLC, Electronic Data Systems UK Limited, Satellite Information Services and Uplink Limited. The companies were chosen from 27 applicants. These companies are entitled to offer one-way, point-to-multipoint specialised services, such as Telex, to specific user groups. These licensees can run up to three uplinks simultaneously. For now, the UK government will postpone consideration of competition in two-way satellite communications. But in 1990, the government will review the duopoly held by British Telecom and Mercury Communications Limited on these and other telecommunication services in the United Kingdom. The new regulatory development could help spur similar market openings elsewhere in Europe, especially because satellite signals often cross national boundaries. The impracticability of enforcing regulation on satellite downlinks means that I would expect other European countries to follow the British example, said Dave Birch, a consultant with Hyperion Services Limited of Guildford, England. In addition, Birch noted, the European Commission has recommended in its Green Paper complete deregulation of one-way downlinks by December 1989. The Green Paper is the Commission's action plan for a competitive pan-European telecoms market. The new UK licensees are planning a variety of services. British Satellite intends to offer private television to closed user groups, as well as virtual circuits for data transmission at up to 2 megabits per second. EDS said it will place emphasis on providing a coherent managed network service. Maxwell Communications is interested in video conferencing, for which it has an agreement with Mercury. Satellite Information Services will be expanding its real-time services for betting shops in the United Kingdom. Uplink Limited has connections with cable TV companies in Britain's Croydon and Reading areas and plans to offer a range of services. British Aerospace is setting up a new division called Baytel, which will offer data, voice, television and private network services aimed at business users.
Select TV purchases Witsend Productions by Patrick Hosking, business reporter in The Independent. Unlisted securities market quoted Select TV, virtually a shell company since the divestment of its cable and satellite television operations in July, is paying £750,000 in new shares for Witsend Productions, makers of Alf Wiedersehen Pet. It also announced a rights issue to raise a net £1.64 million to develop new light entertainment programmes. Witsend is being sold by the former Benlox and Tranwood Group chairman, Michael Buckley, and Alan McEwen, Witsend's chief executive. Together they will control 39% of Select TV. Robert Maxwell's holding, through Pergamon Holdings and through his quoted company Maxwell Communication Corporation, will be diluted slightly to 20%. The underwritten rights issue will also finance the creation of a sales organisation to exploit Witsend's expanding film library. Its television productions include Shine on Harvey Moon, Lovejoy and Girls on Top. Select TV, which is loss-making, also said it intended to reduce its share capital and premium accounts by £4.1 million to eliminate the deficit on its profit and loss account, so that it can in future pay dividends. Our present transmission schedule is fresh programmes on the evenings of Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Saturday.